You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. This is Preference. I'm your host, Hedda. It is April 14th. This is the Cutie Boo slot. Preference takes turns with Trans Positive each week. So tune in for all the great news that we can bring you on queer and trans issues every Tuesday at 6 p.m. I want to take a moment and give a huge shout out, a huge thank you to our newsroom volunteers who every day are putting together great news programming, gathering up as much as we can get on the air and bringing it to you. They're just doing a fabulous job, and I've really been happy to tune into KBOO during the day and get updates on what's happening. So I hope you all are safe and well today. This past Friday, April 10th, was Youth HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. This is one of a series of HIV and AIDS Awareness Days throughout the year set up by the National Institutes of Health and the Center for Disease Control. So this particular day was for youth on April 10th. So I want to play a short video. It's a short talk by Ronald Johnson. He is one of the leaders and a co-founder of Point Source Youth. Point Source Youth is an organization that does a huge amount of work, advocacy, research, and support for folks and organizations working to end youth homelessness in this country. So go check them out online, Point Source Youth. In fact, they have a series of webinars right now on issues related to youth homelessness that anybody can tune in to. And Mr. Johnson, as well as being co-founder and board president of Point Source Youth, spent time in policy and leadership positions with AIDS United, Gay Men's Health, and served as a policy coordinator on HIV and AIDS for two New York City mayoral administration. So we'll hear a several minutes presentation on called HIV AIDS Crisis and Coronavirus Today. So he's going to look at what's changed and what hasn't.
Certainly HIV and AIDS then and the coronavirus now really brings out and highlights the inequalities in a system. And certainly the inequalities in the healthcare system. When you have a society that is really built around classist issues, racist, ethnic and racial disparities, sexism, they play out. It's challenging because, again, when anything happens like HIV, an epidemic, or the coronavirus pandemic, it is the most vulnerable that feel it first. I certainly saw this, and I'm not alone, saw this in looking at how our public health infrastructure has been decimated over the past 10 years. And seeing, particularly when I was still at AIDS United, seeing the CDC's budget and as that trickles down to the state and local levels, it is no surprise to us that the United States has been woefully and I would say criminally unprepared to deal with this epidemic, because our healthcare structure and at the federal government, the amount of dollars that have been cut for public health over the past 10 years is horrifying. And that has left us in the position where we are. This situation where we're all vulnerable to the novel coronavirus, looking back at the early days of HIV, where we knew some of the routes of transmission, but there was a sense of distancing ourselves. I think the real first crisis I remember was when the first staff person at GMHC was diagnosed. And it was a realization of a shock, because I think we all silently thought to ourselves, well, I'm a volunteer or I'm a worker, so I'm immune. The task of taking care of yourself has to be a high priority while you're helping others. We had a massive failure of governmental leadership in the early days of the HIV epidemic. We are seeing massive and disappointing gaps in leadership. I think, and for me, and I hope for you, all of you, it reaffirms the determination that, yeah, we still have a lot of work to do, not only in providing and making sure we get services to those who need them, but to highlight the inequities, to highlight the disparities, to highlight the neglect of our healthcare system. And it highlights the kind of political, governmental leaders that we need.
Back with a couple of folks who work with Basic Rights Oregon, Kieran Chase and Aiden Campbell. Basic Rights is headquartered here in Portland. I'd love to have each of you introduce yourselves for a bit shortly. Kieran, do you want to tell us a little bit about you?
Yeah, my name's Kieran. I use gender neutral pronouns, they, them, and theirs. So if you were to talk about me, you'd say, I heard about Kieran on this radio show. They work at Basic Rights Oregon. I am the manager for Basic Rights Oregon's Transgender Justice Program, which is not a very descriptive job title, but I do a lot of work within and for the trans community. So Basic Rights Oregon's primary, what I would call our primary work is that of passing legislation and supporting legislation that is meaningful to the LGBTQ community, which means legislation that impacts all manner of folks who are experiencing oppression and marginalization, because one thing we know about our community is that LGBTQ folks are immigrants and LGBTQ folks are incarcerated and LGBTQ folks are people of color. So we do a lot of work across different margins and different intersections of marginalization to ensure that folks are experiencing justice and equity. I work specifically with the trans community primarily. I run a leadership program for trans people called Catalyst. I handle a lot of resource referral and answer a lot of questions. I help support passing policy and making sure that when we pass policy, it's not just on the books, but also enacted in a way that means that our community sees justice. It's a very brief overview of what I do.
Before we move to Aiden, I'd love to hear just a little bit about Catalyst now, just sort of a super quick.
Yeah, Catalyst is a program where we take about 20 transgender people from all over the state of Oregon. So Basic Rights Oregon is headquartered in Portland, as you said, but we work statewide. So we bring in folks from all over the state, they apply to be in the program. And we have folks come together for retreats every few months where they get to be in a space where we're only with other trans people and we just get to talk about all of the things that are specific to being a trans person and what it looks like to fight for justice in our community. And we work on developing leadership skills. We support folks in working on projects in their own communities and along the lines of their own interests. So we've done things like supporting running a fundraiser for an all-trans a cappella group. We've helped someone work to publish their novel, whatever trans justice looks like in different folks' lives. We work to support and advance that.
Wonderful. Thanks, Kieran. Mm-hmm. And Campbell, I would love to hear a little bit about you.
All right. So I'm Aiden Campbell. I'm the program director for the Racial Justice and Transgender Justice Programs. And so, basically, you know, like Kieran, we do a lot of policy work on both programs. I am basically supporting Kieran and our other program manager in helping to create content for the trans justice cohorts, Catalyst and Affinity. And we also have another yearly program called Front and Center, which specializes, focuses on queer trans artists of color, and we normally have an artist on a national level come in to perform, and we also focus on local artists, and we highlight 3 to 4 artists on a local regional level during the Front Center program. This year, two of the things I worked on that are big highlights for both programs that I oversee are Addie's Act, which was signed by the governor in June of 2019, and it's basically a suicide prevention program that will be in all schools in Oregon, all I think 198 districts, and it basically provides suicide prevention to young people grades K through 12. And one of the big things we're working on is creating best practice models for those schools so that they can create models that can reach kids from all backgrounds, specifically the communities that have high levels of suicide attempts, which is mostly the indigenous community, the Black community, Latinx, and Asian communities. And also, you know, the LGBT community, and within that community, the trans community has the highest suicide attempt rates. So Addie's Act will definitely be a very important program coming up in the 2020 school fall year when we open back up. The second policy I worked on that was really important last year was the Crime Victims Bill. And basically victims of crimes, and it gives access to resources that are culturally specific. And you said something, did you say something, Alan?
Got choppy, no. Can you just go back half a second?
Okay. The Crime Victims Bill, SB 10, 1008, It focuses on people who have been victims of crimes. And I worked on a policy that was specific to cultural enhancements and also to cultural specific outreach. And we wrote some specific policies to help people know how to reach different communities of color, but also around trauma-informed care, which is very important because a lot of communities of color don't trust law enforcement and especially any agencies that may work with law enforcement. So the policies we wrote around trauma-informed care give those organizations and agencies specific information on how to outreach to those different communities in a culturally appropriate way around trauma so as not to re-traumatize those victims. So that's a little bit about what I do at Pro.
Wonderful. Thanks. Yeah. I would like to pick up with you on what Front and Center has been working on this year.
Yeah. So actually, my plan was this week was to meet with our ED, Nancy, so that we can actually start planning that. And so, of course, like I said, we bring in a national artist, someone that is well known, not just in the trans community, but, you know, within other communities as well. So we'll be focusing on looking for a national artist and also put out a call for proposals for local artists to send us information about the work that they do and, you know, maybe a tape or a video of, you know, their music or written poetry. So this year we definitely expect to be able to do it in some form. If we're not able to do it in person, we'll definitely do it virtually like we're doing, you know, the queer town halls. So we're looking to actually have that, you know, the planning to start pretty soon.
Wonderful. You mentioned just now Nancy, the executive director of Basic Rights Oregon. I was watching Nancy host last week's Queer Town Hall, which I think was the first of the Queer Town Halls. Is that correct?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about what they are, how people can find them, what the upcoming topics are. I think actually we're overlapping with one right now. So.
Yeah, that's right. We're running a Queer Town Hall right now. So we're doing these weekly. They'll be about 90 minutes to 2 hours. We're still figuring out what the ideal length of time is, how long folks can watch a live Zoom call. But essentially what we have is each week a set of panelists, and they'll be talking about specific issues that intersect with the LGBT community around this current crisis and the moment we find ourselves in. So last week, we held a Q&A with legislators. So the legislators on the call were folks who are either people of color or out LGBTQ folks working in our legislature, not just working in our legislature, they're our elected officials. And they answered a bunch of questions and talked in a pretty heartfelt way about taking care of ourselves and what we need to know right now around COVID-19. This week we are talking about gender-affirming healthcare and the status of gender-affirming healthcare like hormones or surgeries right now, as a lot of folks are having surgeries postponed or canceled because of, you know, a lack of PPE and a lack of available medical facilities and capacity to be able to perform those surgeries. And so additionally, folks who typically go in for their appointments to get hormones or to get blood work done or having those appointments delayed and switched to telehealth. So we have representatives right now who are from a couple of the major healthcare systems, as well as the Oregon Health Authority, which administers our state's Medicaid program, the Oregon Health Plan, talking about what the status is of gender-affirming care, what folks can expect, what resources they can access, who they can talk to, who they can call. They're also going to be answering live questions in the second half of the event. So folks can access this by going to YouTube and looking up Basic Rights Oregon's YouTube channel, and then it's currently being live streamed on YouTube. And folks can submit questions and comments that they want asked of the panelists, either by texting a phone number or sending an email address, to an address, both of which are on the screen for that, or by just posting the comments in the YouTube comments. Obviously, folks are listening to this right now, so if you're not able to listen to it live, that's not a problem. You can go back to Basic Rights website or Basic Rights YouTube page later, and you'll be able to find the recording there. But you can subscribe to that channel and get updates on our weekly topics. I know we're planning to talk about undocumented folks and immigrants in the time of COVID. We're planning to talk about housing and houselessness. We're also sourcing ideas from folks who are watching about what they want to hear about. So if you have something that you would like to see talked about in a queer town hall format, we would love to hear from you.
Wonderful. So it is expected to be sort of an open-ended commitment to Tuesdays at 6 weekly, is that right?
Yes, that is the plan right now.
And if folks do want to flip over to that, this program, like almost every other KBOO program, will be archived and available on our website within 24 hours after airing, so folks can come back and listen to this less live. Thanks for that, Karen. What do you feel like, what do each of you feel like Basic Rights priorities really need to be in the rest of this year? I guess that's about 7.5 months, although it doesn't feel like it's gonna feel like 7 months. Yeah, so what's at the top of the list right now?
Yeah, definitely housing, mental health, economic justice. This situation has really shown how systemically trans people are oppressed and, disconnected from services, and especially, important services that keep a lot of us alive, like hormone therapy and gender-affirming surgeries. So definitely, keeping abreast of the community's mental health concerns, the housing issues that we face, and the economic impact it's had on our community. Definitely some priorities that we'll be looking into this year.
I didn't get a sense, I suppose it would be informally, but it might be something that folks are talking about now, that when the rent moratorium, although that's not the right word, ends, and everybody is expected to catch up on their rent, that a lot of folks are just gonna, a lot of folks who are currently have housing are gonna find themselves in some dire straits, and whether there are some sort of specific efforts or work that's gathering to help those folks. Because it seems like it's an extra a sudden expansion of need that we're coming up on.
Right. I know our elected officials are looking into that. I've talked to Earl Blumenhauer's office, and they're looking at, how to, on a federal level, how they can help people with rental assistance. And I know that a lot of people are also doing that on a local level as well. Housing activists are definitely trying to make sure that there are resources to help people in the future and even now in the present. Be able to get money to help them pay for their rent, and also try to figure out ways, once the moratorium is over, how to give people extensions to pay their back rent, because people are just not going to have, $2,000 or $3,000 laying around just to pay back rent. So I know that there are efforts in process to do that on a local level and on a federal level.
Do we know, given that, do we know whether, do we know something about what kinds of stress folks are experiencing now? I know, for example, the local paper ran a story, I guess it must be 5 weeks ago or so, talking about how there's been a rise in folks coming into emergency rooms in the city expressing suicidal thinking, suicidal feeling. So that's one example where we can see the stress of this experience really becoming concrete and dangerous for people. Do you have some other some sense of where else we should be looking to see how this is playing out for people and how it is exacerbating their situations?
Kieran, let's start
with Kieran.
Sure. Something that I'm seeing a lot, and I'm thinking specifically to the LGBTQ community because that's the community that we're, you know, we're focusing on, and something that a lot of folks, imagining you're maybe wondering, like maybe some issues or some points of concern that folks in the wider world may not be aware of or noticing. Something that I want to highlight is one thing is that we know that isolation is an incredible trigger for depression and suicidality, and this sort of enforced isolation or required isolation is going to be very painful for many people, particularly many people who are trans or LGBTQ and maybe don't have a lot of community to begin with, because of the nature of being an LGBTQ person who lives, for example, in like a rural community or in a community where there's not a large population of folks that they can connect to easily. But something that I'm seeing and hearing a lot about is the impact of this on people who are maybe youth or younger folks, or even not younger folks who live in an environment that is not affirming. And so we have this situation where LGBTQ folks, and in particular trans folks, maybe are living with parents and are kind of forced to be home with their parents 24/7, and their parents refuse to call them by their name or to see them as the gender that they are. And so living in that kind of environment 24/7 is going to just really exacerbate maybe problems at home that have already existed, and that person is maybe able to mitigate somewhat by being at school and being out with friends and things that they can't necessarily do right now. Particularly with lack of access to the one, you know, another aspect of this is that all services are still being offered, but they're being offered via like telehealth, being offered via video calls. And for folks who are in an unsupportive environment, something that I've heard is that they don't have a private place where they can talk to their therapist about what's really going on for them. And so these are the things that I'm paying attention to and thinking about as I'm thinking about how we can make sure that the most vulnerable people in our community has their needs met right now.
Thanks for that. Yeah, what can we do to help folks who are feeling isolated right now? I know that's both a huge question and you know, largely an impossible one to make happen easily, but what can we do?
You know, one of the things that I've been doing, I'm working from home like many people are, and I think the nature of having a job in the policy advocacy world rather than in the direct service world is that, you know, I'm not trained to go out and be helping folks do intakes to get into services. I'm not necessarily a person who's equipped to go out and buy groceries for people because of my own life circumstances. And so I've had this kind of question of like, what can I do? Stuck in my house, what can I do? And one of the things that I've been doing is literally just calling people during my workday, just calling the folks who come to mind who I'm like, I wonder if this person could use a friendly voice right now. And making sure that I'm connecting with the folks who I have in my network who are vulnerable, even people who I wouldn't necessarily normally reach out to or who wouldn't necessarily normally expect to hear from me. And so one thing that I would say is if you have a kid who is normally in school and is not transgender, but maybe has friends who are, and you have some idea that maybe they're not in a supportive environment, seeing if you can reach out and connect with them in a way that is safe for them, right? And safe and is not going to necessarily put them in a more dangerous situation at home. I think people need to be reminded that there are folks out here. We still love them. We're still here. We still care. They're not alone, even though it feels very lonely right now.
Indeed. Kieran, are you working on legislative issues right now? And I know that I can sort of take a back seat.
Yeah. Well, the legislature is not in session right now. As folks, you know, may be aware, depending on your level of how much you pay attention to the news, that there's a short session this year and it ended. And right now legislators are considering putting in a or going into a special session to specifically address COVID-19. And there's been sort of a pause and wait on that as the things have gotten worked out on a federal level. What we heard from legislators at the Queer Town Hall last week is that the goal right now is to figure out where the gaps are in the federal aid that's coming, so that as the state is thinking about where to put resources, they're really targeting the places where the federal aid is falling short. And so there's a little bit of a waiting game happening, and maybe not so much a waiting game as like a discussion, an ongoing discussion happening, to figure out how exactly those legislative issues are going to be addressed. And that's in response to COVID. In terms of general legislation, we're always gearing up for the next legislative session. We're still working on setting our legislative priorities for 2020. One thing that folks in the community have certainly asked us about is making sure that any sort of like crisis legislation that gets passed, anything that's sort of a state relief package or anything like that, that we're paying close attention and making sure that we're not, unintentionally causing harm to the community in an attempt to pass crisis legislation that maybe doesn't fully consider the needs of the LGBTQ community, or maybe unintentionally strips some rights or things like that. So we're definitely gonna be paying very, very close attention as things move forward, but right now it's mostly a waiting thing.
And Karen and I were discussing just now mental health concerns with LGBTQ folks, and especially isolation right now. I'm wondering if there's anything you want to add to that.
Just in general or to anything specific?
No, nothing in specific.
It's definitely something to be concerned about. Most trans people are already, pretty disconnected from the communities that they live in general because of being trans and being ostracized in the communities a lot anyway. And so we're already facing high anxiety, a lot of trauma from being ostracized, and being in this position where you're forced to stay in now, and then you're really not able to have community with the people who were supporting you, just to, be who you are, is really traumatizing for a lot of people. So, we're figuring out how we can support more people virtually with some mental health concerns and talk more about mental health, also trauma and suicide prevention. So be on the lookout for some of those things coming up too virtually from us within the next week or so.
Wonderful.
I think I want to add.
Yeah.
Would please. You mind if I add just one more thing? Mm-hmm. Thanks, Alan. I want to mention, so often we talk about, sort of the trauma that trans folks experience and the way that isolation impacts their mental health, and that's all really significant and true, but something that I want to make sure that folks know or think about is the fact that when it comes to isolation, when it comes to the experience of having to like sort of make your own way and figure out who you are and exist maybe without a lot of community support, trans folks are experts at this. Trans folks are resilient and brilliant, and we face adversity. We have faced adversity throughout our history, all over the world, particularly in the United States and in Western culture. We exist in a world that doesn't really make space for us most of the time. And so something that I want to mention is that if you're struggling with figuring out how to deal with isolation and how to deal with sort of this new and scary experience of the world being sort of a frightening and different place, you might chat with your trans friends about some of their strategies for survival in general. I would say, trans people experience trauma and pain, and this is really hard for all of us, and maybe particularly for trans folks. But you can also expect that trans folks have strategies and resilience and tools that may be really valuable.
Wonderful. Thanks, Karen. Thanks to both of you, Karen Chase and Aiden Campbell, for joining us from Basic Rights Oregon. At the end of this hour here on CABO, feel free to flip over to Basic Rights Oregon's YouTube page for the Tuesday evening Queer Town Hall. Last thoughts real quick from either of you?
We're gonna get through this, y'all. We're gonna come out stronger and braver, and we're gonna have a lot better idea of where our problem spots are, and we're gonna work together to make this better. We're gonna take care of our communities. And I am looking forward to giving everyone big hugs on the other side.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to ask for help, you know, whether it's through a call, email, Facebook, you know, whatever social media you use, you know, reach out to people. Don't isolate if you're afraid to ask for help. Just nudge that person that you're closest to, and someone's going to be there to support you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, both of you.
Thanks, Alan.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
We're back. I am on the line with Sasha Buchert, former KBOO News volunteer and program host, formerly with the Transgender Law Center in Oakland, California, and now with Legal Lambda in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Sasha.
Thanks, Alan. Hey, Portland. Hey, KBOO listeners.
Thanks for joining us. Do you want to just give us a real quick hit on what kind of work you're doing out there in D.C., all the way on the other coast?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's a big change for sure, and a big difference, obviously, but very much a lot of great people here like there are in Portland, and, there's a lot of work to be done, across the country on LGBT issues, where obviously a difficult moment, both obviously because of the pandemic, but after 3.5 years of this administration, there's a lot of work to be done on, too many fronts to try to go into, in the time that you've given me, but definitely love being able to do this work. I feel privileged, and there's a whole lot of it needs to be done, for sure. So thanks.
Yeah, we have happily invited you to join us as host of the segment. Tell us about the law, Sasha. I'm wondering if you would. I wonder if you could just give us a short primer on what it is that Legal Lambda does.
Oh, sure. So Lambda Legal is the largest and oldest LGBT legal organization in the country. We started off in the 70s, early 70s, and our main three areas of work, the buckets, are that we do a lot of public education, we do a lot of public policy work, and a lot of litigation. So, we work on, cases involving, relationship recognition. We're involved with all of the marriage equality fights. We've been working on trans issues for many years. We're challenging the ban on open transgender military service. I'm working on a case challenging Tennessee's refusal to amend birth certificates. We do a lot of work on behalf of people living with HIV, and there's lawsuits across the country that, we've brought, challenging, criminalization statutes and different areas of law. So, I'm proud to be part of the organization, and, there's a metric ton of work that needs to be done. I know there's a lot of great work being done by folks in Oregon, ACLU obviously is doing a bang up job in so many different areas. Basic Rights Oregon, there's just so many great groups out back there. I miss all my people back in Oregon. So I just want to give a shout out to all those folks, and I hope everybody's staying safe and hopefully finding peace and sanity you can find in this difficult moment.
Yeah, finding a way to get some sun and some air and still be safe, that's a challenge.
Really?
Yeah. One last question on that. Lambda Legal engages in advocacy and litigation on public policy only, is that right? And that's the core or the whole of the mission?
No, sorry. Well, there's three different buckets of, as I understand it, there's, we do public education, trying to, explain, the disparities the LGBT community and people living with HIV experience. And then there's public policy advocacy, which is, a lot of times it's, work being done to pass, positive laws in different places or to defeat, bad laws in different places. For example, we've been doing a lot of federal policy advocacy in D.C., trying to beat back a lot of the terrible things that the Trump administration has been doing over the last 3.5 years on the federal level. Things like the administrative rules that don't get as much attention in the media, but are, absolutely deadly. Things that, rules, for example, that would allow social service providers to, discriminate against LGBT people, that the Trump administration has tried to do, so that's one example, but there's many, many, many more, not the least of which is data collection on so many different levels, and it's such an important thing, I know we're going to get into this, but it's really important that the next administration, it's not going to be the Trump administration, but the next administration, really get down to brass tacks immediately, because a lot of this is about timing. And the longer it takes to get some of these policy changes, the worse off we'll be over the long term.
Do you sort of reminds me of something that goes around and around in my head when I think about sort of the narrow opportunities that any party or folks working towards the same goal. There are some pretty narrow opportunities to make changes of certain kinds. At the federal level, is there a sense that do you have a sense that legislation is ready to go when new folks are in place to enact it? Is there work being done to make that stack ready? for
I think to answer your question, yes, there is legislation that's primed and ready to go. For example, the Equality Act has, you know, made it through, you know, the House of Representatives this year, and with, a very positive vote. And, you know, of course, the Senate being what it is, the graveyard, as it's called, you know, where legislation goes to die, it's not going to move, you know, until there's a shift in the Senate. But the legislation I'm less concerned about, what I'm more concerned about are, you know, what I consider, you know, there's got to be a better word for this or a better term for this, but are the long-term changes that have to take place. For example, the two that I talk about the most are judges and data collection. You know, the Trump administration has done so much damage to our judiciary, our federal judiciary, by naming, you know, all of these really partisan, you know, ultra-conservative white male judges. And it's so important that, you know, the next administration, whoever it is, it sounds like it's going to be the Biden administration, you know, and hopefully picks the right person, but they really need to move immediately to nominate judges and to fill vacancies, because it takes time, you know, and they could, you know, easily run out the clock on those nominations, you know, the Republicans, if we don't get moving immediately. In the same vein, data collection, you know, there's so many different ways in which we're not counted, you know, whether it's, you know, data collection on, you know, foster youth in the foster system, or data collection for older Americans, or data collection on healthcare disparities. You know, the federal government under the Trump administration has made every effort it could, you know, there was a lack of it before, but what little there was has been diluted or eliminated, for example, with the census. You know, it's so important that we begin the work to immediately implement wherever we can data collection, so that there's the long-term studies that are happening and the data is being collected, you know, progressively as we move forward in time.
I guess the last thought I have on that is, what can folks do right this moment, if anything, to support data collection efforts?
I think it's really important that, you know, one thing I have learned from my many years, but I'm just joking, but the experience I have had with doing public policy advocacy is that it really shocks me how little people, you know, our people, you know, the community, you know, cable listeners too. So, like, it shocks me how few people know who, you know, their representative is. You know, I think some people might know that, you know, their senator, Senator Markley and Senator Wyden, obviously, in Oregon. But some people don't know their personal representative, or their state representative or state senator. And so your voices aren't getting heard, and it's really important that, you know, the ways in which I can see the most effective way to make sure that these things happen are for people to be talking to those people now. You know, maybe not right now in the middle of the pandemic, but why not? You know, it's really important because, you know, why should we be waiting until, you know, after an election to remind folks of how important it is that there's not just legislation that includes data collection, but that there are administrative changes, you know, that happen, you know, across the board, whether it's, you know, when I say administrative changes, I'm talking about the big federal agencies that should be tracking data. I'm talking about the census, you know, within the Treasury Department. I'm talking about Health and Human Services collecting healthcare data on LGBT people. You know, I'm talking about ICE. I'm talking about all of these issues where, you know, these numbers aren't counted. And if you're not counted, then, you know, the appropriations that are made, you know, aren't earmarked for, you know, meeting those needs. You know, so I think that there's a lot of work. I guess I'm saying a lot of different things, but I'm just encouraging people to, you know, take a minute and, you know, contact your legislator. I know that, you know, they're used to hearing people talk, calling them and talking about certain pieces of legislation, and that is important, you know, but, you know, also I think it's important to remind them of what priorities they should be thinking about in advance of the election, and to, you know, urge them to continue to pressure and to continue to develop and work on initiatives that will make sure that, you know, those things that need to happen almost immediately happen, you know, because it's going to take a while for, you know, some of the legislative priorities to work their way through Congress, but a lot of these other things that are slower baked have to get going from the get-go, or there's got to be an effective way to put this. I'm not putting it in the way that I want to, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do understand. The work needs to begin, and I mean, the work always needs to begin. We're always starting from wherever we are. I found a quote earlier today that I want to read to you, Sasha, and our listeners today. This is from Dorothy Day. She's an activist, a radical. She founded the Catholic worker movement. If you really want to get some great stories about who she is and a kind of fervor and passion and legwork that she brought to movement organizing, her autobiography, The Long Loneliness, is an excellent read. So this quote of hers reads like this. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, each one of our words, and each one of our deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There is too much work to do. I think Day was really speaking to the fact that when we organize, when we work, we're doing it as individuals, and we're also doing it collectively. These are steps forward that we're each making with our own bodies and our own minds and our own spirits. And we're also hoping, you know, hopefully we're going in the same direction with other people who are passionate and committed to similar visions as we are. So it's kind of it's finding that balance of individual action and passion and commitment, and also collective, and figuring out how to draw from both streams of spirit.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
How does that, the sensibility that Dorothy Day is putting out there in that quote, how do you think that matches up with what you're seeing as far as organizing towards justice?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, a deep sense of optimism, you know, and hope, you know, in the community. I think one thing that resonates with me, and I think it's easy to go too far with this, but you know, I do. There is something that hits me with regard to, you know, what I believe is a bit of a responsibility, you know, to have some level of hope and optimism in the world, and to move things forward, you know, to make the world a better place than we saw and came when we came. So, you know, I see that in my colleagues, you know, I think there's a lot of fear, obviously, you know, especially that seeing some of the things we've seen, and there is danger.
Oh, we got a little crunchy there on the phone. Can you say that again?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, definitely a sense of optimism in the circle of
social justice that I work in. You know, I think people are tired. It's been a rough, you know, 3.5 years, and you know, worst case scenario, you know, we have to keep going here. We will, but you know, I think overall people see hope, you know, in all the work they do. I don't think you can do this work well without having that sense of optimism and responsibility. I feel like it's a little bit of a duty, you know, to do this work with love and hope.
Well said. Thank you so much. I'm just going to keep thinking about hope as an act, something we do. It's bigger than a feeling. It's a practice. Sasha, I hope you stay safe. I hope you get to see the Terry Blossoms.
And, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll talk with you very soon.
Okay, thanks, Alan. Bye, Portland. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, everybody. This has been Preference. I'm your host, Hedda. Next up is Calculated Conversation. Look forward to seeing you all in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
You were a soldier from the war, waltzing me all the way home. I'd never seen your kind before. Your every word was a poem. Thank you for giving me reasons for living, more reasons than I've ever known. Thank you for giving me new worlds to live in and waltzing me all the way home. Now that you're just a memory, waltzing me all the way home, I hope they treat you tenderly in London, Paris, and Rome. You'll find a lover who looks like your mother. For heaven's sakes, don't be alone. And I'll find a lover who looks like your brother, but never another, waltzing me all the way home. Waltzing me all the way home.
This call is now being recorded.
Wish us luck.
Okay.
We'll be right back. You're listening to KBOO Portland.